Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 28th of May. Judge Sonia Sotomayor, this hour of the program today, and our guest is Barbara Perry. Barbara Perry is Professor of Government, Carter Glass Professor of Government, and Director of the Center for Civic Renewal at Sweetbriar College, author of The Supremes, An Introduction to the Supreme Court Justices, second edition published in 2009. Welcoming phone calls as we talk about President Barack Obama's nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We're welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Professor Barbara Perry, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Great to be with you.
Yeah, nice. I love the title of your book. It's just, I don't know who came up with that title, but it's really a good one, isn't it?
Well,
it makes you dance.
I did, I have to say.
Did you really?
I did. And I begin it by saying maybe people are picking it up thinking it's about Diana Ross. Oh, well.
Well, in the next version, you could do maybe a chapter on her.
Absolutely. I'd add
book.
That in.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a lot to talk about this hour. First of all, let's talk about a diverse court, how important it is to have a diverse court in the United States, if it is important.
I think it is, and I've been thinking about and writing on this topic, I can't believe it, but it's been over a quarter of a century since I started down that road, and I think it is for the following reason. And it's not necessarily what people think in terms of, oh, because an individual person is diverse, that person's going to go down a certain path, though I know we're going to talk about that too. But rather that when people look to the Supreme Court, because it has no authority other than the substance of its decisions and the people who are there and the quality of the people who are there. So first of all, they have to be meritorious, they have to be bright, they have to be well-educated. But if, as a secondary factor, the court looks like America, as we are wont to say in this country, then I think to the extent people pay attention to it, and they do during times like this, when there's a nominee or a hot-button issue is decided on, then I think it's helpful for the court to appear symbolically to be like America. And I think that's one of the main reasons for having it be diverse. And we have to say that it is certainly not diverse now, and except in terms of religion and in some ways going in the opposite direction to being less diverse from having now perhaps six Catholics and two Jewish justices.
Right.
But I think this concept of diversity is one that it hasn't had for many years, for most of its history. But I think it does get a boost in legitimacy and authority if it appears not to be the bastion of one group of Americans.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to be said. Her story, in some ways, similar to the president's story. It's just amazing to me, perhaps because I'm hooked on Abraham Lincoln, who I still can't believe became president of the United States, considering his background. But growing up in a housing project, her parents leaving Puerto Rico during World War II, her father dying when she was so young, it's an amazing story of success, isn't it?
It is. It is absolutely the American dream.
Right.
This is why people crowd to our shores from all points of the world. She is the very embodiment of that. And I have to say, I'm thinking in terms of all of the backgrounds of the current justices, only the ones who were appointed because they had diversity, that would be Clarence Thomas, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in part, and now Sonia Sotomayor, would have been those who have this kind of compelling backstory. And particularly for Clarence Thomas and for Sotomayor, coming from, in his case, abject poverty, and in her case, strapped conditions. And in Ginsburg's case, facing massive discrimination because of her gender, her religion. And by the time she was out on the job market, her maternal status. So she was being told by law firms, can't hire you, in effect, woman, Jew, and mother.
Right.
So I do think that we need to think about that linkage, that these people do embody the American dream, and that also gives them a point in their favor, I think.
Mm-hmm. The New York Times yesterday had this analysis of her, and I'm wondering if you agree or disagree. Her judicial opinions are marked by diligence, depth, and unflashy competence. If they are not always a pleasure to read, they are usually models of modern judicial craftsmanship, which prizes careful attention to the facts and a methodical application of layers of legal principles.
I'll go with the New York Times as the paper of record on that. I have to say I haven't sat down and pored through her hundreds of opinions. But in going through some of the ones that are coming to the fore, including some of the ones that have been overturned by the Supreme Court, I have to say I am struck by her holding fast to the facts, which I think might also make people feel a little better about her, those who are saying, yes, she, by her own admission, is interested in policymaking, or she is going to simply follow her gender and her ethnicity, and that's how she'll make decisions. Again, the results in some areas particularly are very fact-based. I'm a little concerned that they're dull to read because I make part of my living by teaching cases. And the more eloquent they are and the more works of literature they are, the easier they are for me to read and comprehend and much easier for my students to go through. So I'm a little discouraged that they might not be eloquent and elegant in their writing, but if they're based on the facts and the law and she's rather mechanical about it, then more is the better for her argument that she will be a good judge.
Can you learn eloquent?
I don't think so. Can you learn to be a great novelist? I think you're born with that talent.
They also made mention, and this is something the Supreme Court will be taking up, this interesting case brought by firefighters in New Haven, saying that she gave this kind of a cursory treatment, an unsigned decision, affirming the dismissal of the claims from 18 white firefighters, one of them Hispanic, and looking at this whole issue with the Supreme Court has been dealing with how far government can take race into account when making decisions.
That is clearly rising to the top of the list of cases that she will be grilled about, I'm sure, in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, because it involves race. And so, it by definition falls into the hot-button controversial case category. And if the oral argument was any indication, the U.S. Supreme Court may indeed be at this very moment on its way to reversing her, and we should add that she was on the typical three-judge panel on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in that ruling. But the other aspect that you mentioned that's drawing the ire of conservatives is the fact that while the courts have the right to do this, and this is where they are different from the U.S. Supreme Court, most of the time the U.S. Supreme Court, when it takes a case in full and it decides in full, we know that it issues opinions that give us all chapter and verse of why they decided as they did. The lower court decisions can be rendered without a published opinion, and that's the way they started down this road on the Second Circuit with the panel that she was on. So that has also drawn a lot of criticism, and I say it's very unfortunate timing for her that this case that is so on the radar screen and one where she is likely to be overturned will come down in the next 3 to 4 weeks. So just as she is getting ready to go before the Senate panel, it's possible she could have this decision overturned.
Mm-hmm. And where else will she be grilled by the Senate Judiciary Committee?
Everywhere.
Everywhere.
this is where we've come in judicial confirmation hearings, and it's just a fact of our political life. But certainly on that, the Republicans, for obvious reasons, will be grilling her on every possible issue, at which point she will be saying, I'm so sorry, I can't answer that question because that issue will be before the court, I know, or it's already either before the court or it might become before the court. And that's the way all candidates for the court, whether they be appointed by liberal presidents or conservative presidents or Republicans or Democrats, that's the way they handle that. Now, they're also going to zero in, you can be sure, on this statement that's making the rounds and has been ever since her name surfaced several months ago about the policymaking realm of the court and about the issues related to her ethnicity and gender. So that she's stuck on that. She can't say, oh, I'm sorry, that may come before the court. She's going to have to answer mm-hmm. those questions.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting, though, you've got all these years, two decades on various courts, and you find you got people at hard at work trying to find the sentence that's going to be controversial after all she's talked about for 20-some years.
Oh, it's so true, but it is the soundbite media age, is it not? And that's where this is going.
So, of course, the big question is, did she save baseball?
Yes, I think so. From what I read, and I have to say, coming from Kentucky originally, I'm a basketball person myself. But from what I read, she did indeed.
Well, that's in her favor, right?
I would think if one is a basketball fan, or excuse me, a baseball fan, I would think that would be a big point in her favor, whether one's liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican.
Right. From what I understand, the president, when he was doing the final interviews, was looking mostly at women, and the finalists were all women. Why do you think this choice was made instead of, say, someone like Janet Napolitano?
I take the president at his word on this, in part because of those four he interviewed. And they were all highly qualified. In some ways, Sotomayor is the most controversial and certainly has the longest track record on the bench, which, as you indicate, then gives much fodder for controversy and for opposition. So I take the president at his word that he was just bowled over by her personal story, by her backstory, as we call it, by her biography, by the fact that it was, I'm sure, so similar in his mind to his. And that I'm sure that she overwhelmed him with her personality. She seems to have a sparkling personality, and I'm sure that he was able to see how she was able to overcome those difficult circumstances. And this is another factor that I'm hoping to write about soon, and that is the role of the job interview in the appointment of Supreme Court justices. This is a very new phenomenon, and one that, by the way, worked for Justice Ginsburg. She was picked originally over Justice Breyer, because she made a much more positive impact on President Clinton than did Breyer at the time, though we know that the next year he got his chance. And the same is true for now Chief Justice Roberts. It was said that he, both in preliminary interviews with other members of the Bush administration and then with the president, in part got the nod because of his performance face-to-face. Fascinating.
And when you say this is new, does that mean that other nominees were not interviewed?
Yes, this is a very new phenomenon.
Really?
And I would say, going back to one of the first that I can remember was the Sandra Day O'Connor meeting between herself and Reagan. And it was almost a done deal by the time she got there. He didn't know her, for example, and as we know, was more of a hands-off president. So his aides, including Ken Starr, who was working in the Reagan administration at that time, had done on-site interviews with O'Connor out in her home state of Arizona. But it's really since the 1990s that this has come to pass, and I think it's a fascinating development.
Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Barbara Perry, Carter Glass Professor of Government, Director of the Center for Civic Renewal at Sweetbriar College, and author of The Supremes, An Introduction to the Supreme Court Justices. We have two lines open if you want to join us, and tons of email space. The lines are 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, the email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Scott from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Hi.
I guess I'm trying to learn as much as I can about the nominee as possible to get a good picture of it. But the thing that seems to bother me more than anything else is how this is being sold by the administration and the press. I mean, it's great that she has a great life story, but so did Miguel Estrada, and that really didn't matter. And he really got lambasted by the Democrats and the press when George Bush tried to nominate him to the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. It seems like there's a double standard between the Bush nominees, and now we're supposed to basically just rubber stamp this one. I mean, the Republicans are already hearing you're going to pay if you put up a fight, while both the Bush appointees to the Supreme Court never got 60 votes. I mean, it was always in the 50s. Barack Obama voted against Alito and Roberts, who, in my opinion, are far more qualified than the appointment of Barack Obama's first candidate. And it just seems there's a different position when a Democrat nominates somebody than a Republican.
Why do you think she's not qualified, Scott?
I didn't say she wasn't qualified. I was saying, I never said she wasn't qualified. I said I was trying to learn as much about her as possible. What I was saying was, is Roberts and Alito are very qualified.
Are more qualified than
Obama didn't vote for either of them. I never said she wasn't qualified. I said I didn't know. I was trying to learn as much about her as possible.
Uh-huh. Professor Perry.
Well, on the issues of qualification, if you do want to compare directly to the Bush 2 appointees, two of the Bush 2 appointees, and that would be Roberts and Alito, John Roberts was widely viewed by all sides as the greatest legal mind of his generation. So probably anyone, including Alito, could not quite come up to that standard. But head-to-head, certainly Sotomayor and Alito are even. And in fact, she may be a step ahead of him because they both graduated from Princeton University as undergrads. She graduated as the second in her class. So she was, again, just a little bit ahead of him in terms of a head-to-head matchup at the same institution, though not at the same time, perhaps.
I'm sorry, Scott.
That between that, the fact that she graduated summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, from Princeton on to Yale Law School, editor on the Yale Law Journal, and even has more experience than Alito on the federal bench, though he had 15 years, she has 17. So I think that her qualifications are unassailable. Now, back to the caller's original point about what kinds of deals these nominees get in the press and among Democrats and Republicans in the Senate. Usually these decisions come down to which party has control of the Senate. That's just a political and partisan fact of life. The Founding Fathers considered very carefully how to choose members of the federal judiciary. They spent a good while speaking about it in the Philadelphia Convention in 1787, and they talked about a number of alternatives, and this is the one that James Madison proposed. As always, he'd come up with the compromise that they would eventually decide on, with the president nominating and with the concept of advising consent of the Senate, either confirm or not confirm. But the founders didn't reckon on political parties. They weren't thinking in terms of political parties and that kind of partisanship. So they certainly couldn't have foreseen that. Even if they could have, they could not have foreseen this internet age in which we live, whereby these appointments become more and more contentious.
Mm-hmm. They surely couldn't have envisioned this kind of – I couldn't have envisioned this kind of society not that many years ago.
Indeed.
It's a whole different place. Politics, of course, at play here for both the Republicans and the Democrats who would like to court and who are courting the Hispanic vote in this country. How does that play in? How careful do the Republicans have to be with their comments? I would think that Newt Gingrich's comment on Twitter, Latina woman racist, should withdraw, doesn't help court that vote at all. How was that, of course, a factor in the Obama decision to court somebody who the Democrats would like to grow their appeal to the Hispanic voter?
That you can definitely say was a part of this decision, and that goes back to a long tradition in presidential appointments that have been what we call representative of certain groups in society. In fact, George Washington wanted a diverse and balanced court based on geography. That is where the justice came from, because that was important in our politics in those days, and it was important up to the 20th century. And then when we became less split geographically and became larger, and obviously there eventually ended up with only 9 seats and we had 50 states, you cannot represent every state. But presidents were representing geographic regions, and then when we became so sectionally divided north and south, they were representing in that way with the justices. Then the issue of religion came to the fore with this vast influx of Jews and Catholics into the United States in the 1800s. And so a Catholic seat developed on the court and a Jewish seat developed. And then Ronald Reagan, who was absolutely steadfast against affirmative action, appointed Sandra Day O'Connor the first woman because he was courting the women's vote. So presidents have courted geographic groups, religious groups, gender groups, racial groups, and now ethnic groups. by their Supreme Court appointments. And it makes it seem less pure to those of us who'd like to think that only the merit of the justice is at issue.
Yes. Thank you, Scott. Dave is next from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning to you both, and I appreciate this opportunity. I'd have to agree with the earlier caller about the double standard, and it bothers me, too, and I see it both ways. But it's kind of interesting. Last night, and I suspect that these are on YouTube now, last night, two of the issues that they're talking about, the criticism comes from Obama's statement earlier on that he wanted to select a candidate who would have empathy, which some people, of course, confuse with sympathy. But the other one has to do with a comment she made about her background as a Latina, permitting her to, I think she used the word better decisions, and I'm not sure that that was the proper word. But there are YouTube clips now showing when George H.W. Bush appointed Clarence Thomas, one of the points that he made was that Clarence Thomas, because of his background, would be able to have empathy. And there's also a clip of Samuel Alito during his confirmation hearing where he talks about his parents being Italian immigrants and about the discrimination against Italian Americans and how that would permit him to have a better understanding of issues. And if you read the complete statement that Sotomayor made, what she and Samuel Alito said are almost identical. They're almost identical statements, exactly the same meaning and making the same point. So I think that people who begin to criticize this appointment had better look back at some of the former justices during their hearings or their notifications. And one further point, Karl Rove has made this comment, I'm paraphrasing now, but that she's not bright enough, or mm-hmm. I forget what term he used. And he said he knows a lot of people who graduated from Harvard who were not very bright, and I'm sure that he does because he worked for one of them.
Okay, Dave.
Okay, thank
you. Yeah, I heard that comment as well and thought it was a bit out of line. She's obviously a very intelligent woman.
Yes, one can graduate from an Ivy League school and not have common sense, not to say that one is not bright,
right.
Particularly again when she graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa. Phi Beta Kappa is the most meritorious honor society, as we know, and the oldest in this country. So there's no way she could have gotten that except for being bright. But the caller raises just a number of important issues. I'm not a YouTube aficionado, so I can't say that I saw the quotes that he's referring to, but if indeed Alito said that, or that Bush the First said that about Thomas, I wouldn't be surprised, because in this country, while we, as a legal aspiration, believe that we should be colorblind, both in our personal dealings and certainly our Constitution and our laws should be colorblind, we do focus on people's personal stories and how they have overcome this discrimination that we have had in our country against all sorts of groups. So I think that that's probably true, that Sotomayor is not the first person to have this said about her, that she's overcome discrimination. But I do recognize that many people view it as problematic that she did say that a wise old Latino woman would come to a better decision than a white judge. She was, however, going back to a statement that Sandra Day O'Connor had made, trying to indicate that gender didn't have an impact on her decisions by saying a wise old man and a wise old woman would come to the same decision. And to the mix, Sotomayor added her Latina heritage.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a few more moments on empathy. The president talking repeatedly about how important empathy is. What's the role of empathy in the Supreme Court decisions that are made? How do you determine whether somebody has empathy?
I would think it would be difficult. I think that he's deciding that Sotomayor has empathy in part simply based on her background. But I should say that this is where I think the personal face-to-face interview with the president comes to the fore, that most of us, even in a an hour-long conversation with someone can get a sense of that person's personality. So I suspect for this president, he took this woman's biography and then put it together with his hour-long questioning of her, and then she spent, by the way, 7 hours in the White House being interviewed by others who must have reported to the president. So that's one issue. How do you determine empathy? Second, your first part of your question was about how would we know if someone was being empathetic on the U.S. Supreme Court? I can give you two quick examples of that. I attended the oral argument last month in the student strip search case that made headlines, and I happened to be sitting right in the front row, and there were 8 men on the court and Justice Ginsburg. And for the first 10 minutes of that case, Justice Ginsburg tried every way to Sunday to get people to understand what it's like to be a 13-year-old girl made to disrobe in front of two female school administrators. And she tried and tried and tried, and no other person on the bench picked up on it. No man on the court said, well, I've never been a 13-year-old girl, but I guess that could be really embarrassing, couldn't it?
Oh, that's interesting.
And finally, she just stopped. Justice Ginsburg, in effect, threw up her hands. And in the meantime, Justice Breyer said, well, I don't see what the big deal is. You change clothes in school all the time for gym. And then he made the comment that will go down in history, and we still to this day don't know what it meant. He said, people were putting things in my underwear all the time.
Oh, my gosh.
To which there was
that
outburst by 300 people in the courtroom, the biggest laugh I've ever heard in the U.S. Supreme Court. So that, I think, is the very essence of empathy.
And didn't she rule on this, am I getting this wrong?
You mean Justice Ginsburg or Justice Sotomayor?
Sotomayor. Yes.
She did. And I think empathetically, so I believe it was a mentally disabled student who had been strip searched. And if I recall correctly, Judge Sotomayor ruled in favor of the student and her right to privacy that she had certainly been violated.
Hmm. Thanks, Dave, very much for your call. Let's go next to Kyle from Baraboo. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
It's probably beating a dead horse at this point, but first of all, I just want to say it's great that you appointed somebody that came up from the bottom. I think the court desperately needs that. But the one thing that concerns me, it's the same thing that's being force-fed throughout the media, is, you know, the comments that she made about her being better able to make a decision. What I'm curious about is, are you concerned that maybe, you know, she's bringing a grudge to the court? Is she going to rule? And I don't know what her track record is, but is there a question that she might rule more in favor, you know, towards minorities or, you know, things that could potentially increase, you know, racial tensions? And also, is there even a track record of that with the others, like, say, Alito or Roberts with their, you know, religion or any of the others? I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
All right, Kyle.
I'll start with the last point first. Good question about religion. As I mentioned earlier, if Sotomayor is confirmed, she will be one of 6 Roman Catholics on the bench. And caller mentioned about Roberts and Alito and their religion. They would deny this, and I have heard directly Justice Scalia in person deny that his religion, his Roman Catholicism, has an impact on his abortion jurisprudence. But I think it would be a safe bet to say that for the 3 rock-ribbed conservatives on the bench now, who are also Catholic, Roberts, Alito, and Scalia, who all happen to be pro-life, that there could be a linkage between their upbringing in a conservative church atmosphere, particularly Roman Catholicism, and their votes in abortion cases. I think it's a fascinating point that I haven't heard anyone else raise about whether Judge Sotomayor could be carrying a grudge. I guess that remains to be seen. I do know that she ruled in a case that a Hispanic woman had brought that came all the way to the Second Circuit about having been discriminated against in the workplace. She worked at a Coach store, the Coach handbag and leather store, and said that she had had a hostile work environment based on her gender, but that she'd also been discriminated against on the basis of her race and ethnicity. And here's where I go back to my original point about Sotomayor looking at the facts. Sotomayor ruled in favor of the woman on gender and said that she thought there had been a hostile work environment and gender discrimination, sexual harassment. But she didn't rule in the woman's favor on the racial and ethnicity. issue. So I think she was very fact-based there. I don't think that would indicate she was carrying a grudge for being Hispanic or a Latina, because if she had been doing that, she would have voted in favor of the woman's claim based on her race and ethnicity.
Mm-hmm. The other issue is, somebody's made the point that the abortion issue seems to be somewhat dormant right now. You never know when that will change. But the issue that she is likely to face probably sooner is the gay marriage issue. And I'm wondering if we can look at her record and see where she's going on that. And it's another one of those issues where perhaps religion may play a role.
I think you're right, first of all. The only case that I've seen that she voted in that had anything to do with abortion, she actually came to a pro-life result. And it was about the law that requires that foreign organizations that take U.S. funding may not participate in abortions or advocate for abortions. And she voted to uphold that law. So she doesn't have a lengthy record here. But I think you're right that the gay rights issue, probably via California and the case that the Supreme Court of California heard the other day, we already know that that's being appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Interestingly, via Ted Olson and David Boies, the two lawyers who were on opposite sides in the Bush v. Gore controversy.
Sure. Oh.
So that'll be fascinating in and of itself.
Yes.
She, again, I cannot find cases in which she has voted on this. She was asked directly a question about homosexual rights or gay rights in her circuit, the circuit confirmation hearing back in 1997-98. She was asked by then-Senator John Ashcroft if she thought that there was a constitutional right to homosexual conduct, in this instance by prisoners. I think there had been a case involving a prison inmate who was homosexual who was not allowed to serve food in the prison. And she responded, "No, sir, there is not. The only constitutional right that homosexuals have is the same constitutional right every citizen of the U.S. has, which is not to have the government action taken against them arbitrarily and capriciously."
Hmm. So who knows where
right.
she would be
yeah,
on
unknown.
The issue. Right, yeah,
unknown.
Interesting.
But she didn't say, absolutely, the Constitution
right.
protects gay rights in all manifestations thereof.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email that's come in. This is somewhere in the recesses of my mind, but I can't remember the decision. And if you do, that's fine. If you don't, it's okay. Email from Ken from Monona. I've read that this judge supports the Kelo decision on eminent domain, Kelo versus the City of New London. Is this true? And we'll need to be briefed on what that is, I think, too. If it is
yes, I can refer listeners to the Washington Post yesterday's edition, in a case called Brody versus Village of Port Chester. It says that she ruled with the majority that the Village of Port Chester violated a property owner's due process rights by failing to give adequate notice of his right to challenge the determination that his land should be used for a redevelopment project. Now, that would put her on the other side of the Supreme Court's Kelo decision. However, the last sentence in this description says, "Nevertheless, the panel supported the right of the government to take property for public use." That was the core of the Kelo decision. You might remember it was an elderly woman's home that was taken over by the city to be used for a planned business development. And first of all, as you can imagine, all Americans get very agitated to think that the government can take property. But the way the Constitution is written is that they can take property for public use, and the issue in Kelo was, is it really public use if it's going to be for private development? The city made the case of, oh, we'll get more tax money. So that had a huge impact in the United States at the time. It seems like an esoteric kind of legal question, but it's talking about people's homes.
Right.
And so many state legislatures responded to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in that case that, again, was in favor of the city in Connecticut. And many of these state legislatures have passed laws making it more difficult for state governments to take people's property.
We go next to Carl from Dodgeville. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
Hi.
My question actually relates to what you just brought up, and I was wondering what her record on corporate and business issues were and consumer issues. If I understand you correctly, she basically backed up the government's claim that it could take individuals' property for commercial development rather than for general public use. So that would seem to indicate to me that she favors corporations and business in a general way. I haven't heard anything about where she stands on that. But if she's in line with Clinton's appointees, I think Breyer and Ginsburg both have a very pro-corporate background. So I wonder if you could speak to this.
Ginsburg does not have a pro-corporate background. She was an academic and worked solely in the area of women's rights. Breyer, yes, is more, I would say, a bit more corporate in his outlook. I would say that business interests have actually spoken out positively about Judge Sotomayor's background and record, and said, I think the way, Kathleen, you started the program by saying that she's very careful and, again, somewhat mechanistic in her decisions, and certainly I think in the business realm is as well. I would draw some distinction between this so-called eminent domain case line of when government can take private property and then her corporate law outlook. But she did work in a corporate law firm in the interest of corporate clients. So that is another element that she brings to this mix, where, as you would think, given her backstory and her biography, that she would be more like Justice Ginsburg, a champion of the downtrodden. She has a fuller background and set of experiences that probably overall is somewhat mixed in the corporate realm. But as I say, what I've read from corporate interest groups is that they are not bothered by her appointment.
More phone calls in a moment. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. This hour, we're talking about the nomination of Judge Sonia Sotomayor to fill the seat being vacated by David Souter. And our guest is Professor Barbara Perry, Professor of Government, Director of the Center for Civic Renewal, Sweetbriar College, and author of The Supremes, An Introduction to the Supreme Court Justices, this year in its second printing. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening. Oh, let me give you the email again, too, because you can use that. That's talk@WPR.org. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about the link between our environment and our health. All right, let's take another email here for Professor Barbara Perry. Somebody who wants more information just on her personal life, Dave from Madison. Is she married, living with a partner? Does she have children?
She is divorced, as I understand it, married fairly young and divorced fairly quickly, was only married a short time, and she does not have children. And from what I understand, she lives alone, but is very close to her brother and his wife and his family and nieces and nephews that he has.
All right.
And her mother, of course. I think it's wonderful that her mother is here and extant and could sit in the East Room in the front row and see the president nominate her,
right,
even if she would not be confirmed. That in and of itself must have been a triumph for her mother.
Can you imagine that, sitting as a mother in that situation and seeing your daughter nominated to the Supreme Court?
I just picture my mother, though, in that situation and how she would have been feeling, and my dad, too.
Right. Let's go to, is it Braden from Madison?
Yeah, Braden.
Hi, Braden.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. My question for the guest is, I was hoping to get back to the comment made by Sotomayor about, I don't know how exactly to put it, but her being Latino American, that one-ups her, you know, automatically. Did you see what I'm saying, the question? Because of that, I was hoping to see, there hasn't been actually an address of whether or not this comment is valid or not, whether or not it actually has any strength or weight to it. It's already been, like, dismissed as racist or whether or not. And I was hoping to maybe discuss what comment, this comment that was made, whether or not it would actually make any sense outside of the sphere of a judge or another public official.
Well, the issue, I think, comes down to at this concept, as I say, of representativeness, which scholars, and particularly Professor Henry Abraham at the University of Virginia, is the scholar of Supreme Court appointments. And in his book called Justices, Presidents, and Senators about the Supreme Court appointment process and history, he actually identified representativeness as one of the three historical factors presidents have used in making appointments. That representativeness can fall into two categories. One can be symbolic, which we've talked about, people looking at the court and saying, oh, there's someone there who looks like me, or someone there who looks who comes from my group. That's a kind of a passive symbol. Then there's the active concept, whereas a president puts someone on the bench because he or she will vote in favor of that constituency, which tends to take most of us aback because we don't view judging in that way. We view judging as needing to be neutral. Then we need to look at the difference, for example, between Clarence Thomas, who doesn't, he's a symbol for African Americans, but he doesn't vote their interests most of the time. As an example, he's against affirmative action. And the difference between him and Thurgood Marshall, who did vote in favor of African-American rights and interests. I would also take Justice O'Connor as an example. She told me in a personal interview in the mid-'80s when I asked her about her gender and its impact on her life and judging, and she said, we are all the sum total of our experiences, but I try to leave those experiences at the threshold of this court when I walk through the door each morning. And I took her at her word, and I believe that that is exactly what she tried to do and what most judges attempt to do when they're trying to be neutral. But we have to say that Justice O'Connor, if you look back over her 25 years on the bench, voted almost always in favor of the women's rights issue when it came before her, even though sometimes that was a very liberal decision, and she was noted as being a moderate conservative. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is, yes, these backgrounds often do have an impact on judging. And I think Sotomayor was just being frank about that. But I do understand the controversy surrounding it, and I understand why people are taking issue with it, as well they should, because it is a controversial comment that she made, and she should be questioned severely about it.
Thanks very much for your call. We go to Matt from Middleton next. Hi, Matt.
Hey, good morning, ladies.
Hi.
I am wondering, how does an appointment or a judge, how are they reviewed when you look at their previous rulings that have been overturned by a higher court? And does that point to maybe an indication of their read on the law or their clarity on the law? How many times has this appointee been overruled by a higher court?
As best I can determine, about four times, at least this is what the New York Times focused on, and I think that Tom Goldstein, who writes SCOTUS blog, indicated this as well. I think that Sotomayor's cases have been appealed up to the Supreme Court five or six times, and about three of her decisions were overturned. One of her decisions when she was on the U.S. District Court was overturned by the Second Circuit that she eventually would go on herself. So let's say roughly a handful of cases of her decisions have gone on, and then particularly to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think is most important here, and been overturned. So it's been a rate for her of about 75%, which I understand is about the rate of overturning of all cases that come to the U.S. Supreme Court. So she's not out of the mainstream on that. And the other thing that we'd have to take note of is that she does tend to be a more liberal judge on the Second Circuit, and the court now is more conservative, and in fact has been conservative since the Reagan years. So it would make sense that a more conservative Supreme Court might tend to overturn more frequently the decisions of a more liberal justice or judge. But I don't think that that means that she's unqualified to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. It means that she has been serving as a more liberal federal judge at a time when the U.S. Supreme Court has been more conservative.
Thanks, Matt. Patty from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I'm enjoying this discussion very much. I'm thinking about it, though, in broader terms about how we view the Supreme Court in particular and how, I mean, we talk about all these different specific issues where a lot of the times there are such smart and competent people on both sides, opposite sides of an issue, and both opinions sometimes are equally valid, and we sort of look to the Supreme Court to say, well, here's the right answer, when actually, if you really think about it, what is the right answer? Is it the answer that the majority of people believe in, or is there some broader right answer that these people can discern, you know, because they're smart, whereas really, smart people can disagree about some pretty significant things.
That is so true. That is a truism. I would look to two justices to guide us here. Justice William Brennan, who served from 1956 to 1990, was very famous as an excellent marshaller of the court, and he would ask his law clerks when they'd come in every year at the beginning of the year, what's the most important word at the court? And eagerly they'd say, liberty, justice, freedom, rights. And he'd say, no, 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 and then finally he'd hold up his hand and spread out the fingers and say, five. The most important word here is five, because five rules. Five out of nine wins the case. And the caller is right to note that smart people can disagree. And the great thing about the court, we focused here today a lot on controversy and people's differences, but the great thing about this bench is that it eventually comes to these decisions, and sometimes they vehemently disagree with each other, 5-4 on these hot-button issues. But I would point to someone like Justice O'Connor, who, with her background, because she tended to be more moderate, perhaps also because she came from a political background, she was the first female majority leader of a state senate. This was out in Arizona. She was able to find that middle ground. So I think the caller is right to say a lot of smart people can disagree and disagree vehemently. What we look to the court to do is find an answer that, at least this is what I look to the court to do, to find an answer that sometimes is in the middle, because that's where the common sense is.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? I wonder if people are reaching at straws here, or if it's just kind of gossipy, or if it's important. I heard two different things on various news reports last night. One was that there was concern from liberals that she be strong enough to be able to hold her own with conservative members of the court, like Alito and Roberts and Thomas. And the second thing was, well, she's got this reputation of not being able to get along with anybody.
I would say that latter falls into the gossipy category.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when did being cheerful and friendly become the criterion for being a Supreme Court
justice?
And to me, I hear some sexism in those kinds
of
comments.
So do I. I'm glad you said that.
I just have to say it, and that's probably where my gender comes into play,
right.
But I do. Going back to the liberals' comment, though, and the criticism, and there had been, before she was named, there had been this piece by Jeffrey Rosen in the New Republic, I believe, taking her to task as perhaps not being strong enough intellectually, or maybe not being able to hold her own with some of the bright lights of Scalia and Roberts, et cetera, on the bench. Again, I just have to go to her academic background and her long experience on the bench, and the little I have seen of her on C-SPAN, for example, when she served on a moot court at George Washington University Law School, or this video that they did of her participating in oral argument. I've been to well over 100 oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court. I have been proud of Justice O'Connor and Justice Ginsburg as a woman because they did hold their own and do hold their own against the males on the bench. And Justice Thomas, who is a male, says nothing. So you know, people fall into these different categories. Some ask questions all the time, some a moderate amount, some a little. I think that she will ask questions at a sharp clip, and they will be bright and informed questions should she make it to the top court in the land.
Slightly off the topic, but I've wondered, why doesn't Thomas talk?
He has given several reasons for that. One is that he was raised speaking an African-American dialect on the coastal islands off of Georgia called Gullah, and he said that that gave him a pronounced accent that he was embarrassed about and that he didn't speak up in school because of it, and that's carried over to him. The other is that he says if he wanted to be talking, he would be out in front of the bench as an oral advocate and a lawyer. And finally, he said his grandparents who raised him taught him you cannot talk and listen at the same time, and that he prefers to listen.
Huh. We have time for one more phone call. Patty, thanks for your call. This is Tammy from Onalaska. Hi.
Good morning, ladies. My question originally was whether she was strict constitutionalist or not, but I think in listening and waiting on the line, I've gotten my answer on that. So I guess the question, if you'd permit me, that I want to modify a little bit in regards to the last couple of callers, is that when you look at the law of non-contradiction, of something can be, two things can be wrong, but not necessarily both right. And you look at the aspect of personality and how that all plays a part in making judgments. you really, like when you're out in the middle of the ocean and you need a compass. You need to know which way is north or south to know where you need to get to and how to get there. And I think that's what the Constitution does for us. And I really want to encourage people to think in terms of truth. And
okay, I need to hold you there because we only have 10 minutes or 10 seconds for a response. Professor Perry?
I agree that the Constitution is our compass and it's our true north. It's our guiding star, to mix lots of metaphors.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Perry. It was a great hour.
Oh, you're
appreciate
so welcome,
it.
Kathleen. I enjoyed it immensely.
Good, good. I'm glad to have you with us. And we'll talk again. Professor Barbara Perry, Carter Glass Professor of Government and Director of the Center for Civic Renewal at Sweetbriar College. Her book is now in its second edition this year, and it is titled, I love this title, The Supremes, An Introduction to the Supreme Court Justices. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your brilliant calls. We'll return following the latest news and talk more on this Thursday morning. It's a minute now before 10. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.